Leonidas, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. All right, Leonidas, you are a co-founder of Ord.io. You are the host of the Ordinal Show, and you're also helping to spearhead the Runestone Airdrop Initiative, which is really freaking cool. We'll dive into all that soon. But take me all the way back. How did you first get involved in NFTs? How did you discover NFTs? Because you have a really cool history within this space, and I want to learn all about that.
It's an honor to be here. Really appreciate you having me, Andrew, and happy to dive into my kind of crypto journey here, hopefully pretty quickly. I started mining Bitcoin on my laptop about 9 years ago, a little over 9 years ago, and that was just me as like a kid having fun. You see these crazy charts of Bitcoin in 2013 going way up, and you just get intrigued by the tech. I'm a software developer. I then got really into ETH when it came out, right? Got to play CryptoKitties, was familiar with ERC-721, OpenSea came out, got to see kind of all of that little moment happen there. And then largely during the bear market, everything sort of, at least from my perspective at the time, had died off. And I went and, worked for companies outside of the space and came back. And around late 2020, it came onto my radar that ERC-721 is now a thing again. So took all my money, started, trading, collecting these NFTs, and specifically was focused on early NFTs. I didn't understand, like I would go to Super Rare and I didn't understand that market at all, but I knew that the two NFTs that I had heard about, CryptoPunks and CryptoKitties, were I knew they were old. And I was like, that these seem like they're like the coolest NFTs because they're some of the first ones. It turns out there's obviously a lot more earlier NFT experiments than those two. But that really got me into NFTs. My real name is not Leonidas. I created this Leonidas kind of persona on Twitter just because I love the movie 300. And yeah, researched the history of NFTs, studied NFTs, collected lots of early NFTs. And then through all of that, I met this guy named Casey Roddenmore 2 summers ago. And he was sharing with me this like sort of crazy idea that he had figured out a way to number all 2.1 quadrillion Satoshis on the Bitcoin network. So turning them each into non-fungible tokens so that they can be tracked as they move around the network. I didn't fully like comprehend at the time, like the implications of that. It turns out, he releases that idea as the Ordinals protocol 6 months later, and the rest is history, right? So very much embedded in the space for a little over a year now, and it's been incredible to just watch the space grow up, and there's a real ecosystem here now, and I'm extremely excited about the future of Web3 arriving on Bitcoin.
That's amazing. Okay, so take me back to the historical NFT period when you were first getting involved in a more major way into the NFT scene, because I remember, so I wrote a blog post about, it was like history of NFTs. This is like an, I don't know, end of 2019, early 2020, I forget when, but I just like, just did some Googling. I didn't even really know if it was like that accurate. I was like, I think this is like relatively accurate. And I put up this post about, there's this thing and this project, et cetera, and kind of showcasing that throughout the years. And then you came on the scene, I remember, and I was like, man, Leonidas has just bangers of content, like really digging deep into what the actual history of NFTs is. Because I was like sloppy and lazy and just like whatever. Your stuff was incredible. And you dug so deep where you were able to find really, really interesting things. I feel like a lot of people didn't really understand or realize that was this project was X old or whatnot. How are you, I guess like first of all, what was the thesis? You're like, okay, I want to collect early stuff. Why? And then how did you go about researching and finding these different projects?
The thesis for historical NFTs is an interesting one. And it's mostly based around this idea of scarcity and kind of a collectability around these very early experiments. Most of these early experiments going back, I mean, Bitcoin NFT experiments were happening around 2014, 2015, for example. These people weren't necessarily just trying to become millionaires or, becoming giga rich off of the NFT space. They were like usually, I've been fortunate enough to interview a lot of them, and they're usually very like technically inclined folks that are seeing this new technology and sort of using their artistic side to somehow turn it into a medium for maybe the art that they're creating, or a lot of them weren't even artists. They were really just experimenting with the technology. But it became pretty clear to me, there was this moment called the Mooncat Rescue in March of 2021, where somebody found this old smart contract on Ethereum that had NFTs in it that nobody had remembered. It had been forgotten. And I watched as it went from nobody caring about it to minting out and having $100 million market cap in literally a matter of hours. So it just instantly clicked to me in that moment. I was like, you know, what are the odds that there's not some other projects back there, right? You know, there's clearly value, just like there's value in, you know, scarce old comic books or anything that's scarce, and that scarcity is driven through time because you can't go back in time and create more of the thing. Whereas you could create an infinite amount of NFTs in 2024, for example. We know there's only a handful of smart contracts from 2017 now that have tokens that are non-fungible in them. So people go back and collect these. And I just spent a lot of time researching, spending time trying to construct these timelines, you know, would share that information out. I think people kind of know me back from that moment for the timelines that I created and the research I did there. And that actually led me to, you know, having this multi-chain thesis, I think, before a lot of people. Shout out to folks like White Rabbit and a handful of folks who helped kind of onboard me to the Bitcoin counterparty ecosystem with the rare Pepes and the Spells of Genesis and all of these really amazing early assets. And that's really why like Ordinals kind of instantly resonated with me, because I'd already kind of overcome this notion that you only do valuable NFTs on Ethereum. I already held valuable NFTs on Bitcoin from these sort of OG projects. So always was very excited about the notion of NFTs on Bitcoin, and I've had a collection there for several years. And then Ordinals comes out and it just kind of clicks a little bit easier, where I think there's a lot of folks where, you know, you collect NFTs on Ethereum and someone comes along and says, hey, collect NFTs on Cardano. It's like, do I really want to collect NFTs on Cardano? Like maybe not. I don't know. No throwing shade on Cardano. I'm just saying like, it's safer to just stay on Ethereum, where there's a network effect. There's a lot of value. But I had this kind of thesis around Bitcoin, really just because of those historical kind of NFT researching days, where I don't really care what chain the NFT is on. I want to go find these NFTs on any blockchain, and I want to talk to the people who created them. And that's what I did for several years.
Okay, so you don't care what chain the NFT is on. That's so interesting, because I care a lot, because I'm always like, man, like I don't want, you know, NFTs on Cardano, right? You know, it could be like the most beautiful piece of art, but I'm like, man, this is kind of a dead chain. I don't really want to be here. And there's also something you said about like, you know, early is more historical. It's better in some sense for like collectability, but also there's an issue of like accessibility, right? Right. It's like Counterparty and Rare Pepes the Rare Pepes and Spells of Genesis on Counterparty, you know, they're hard to access for most people. Right. So that impacts the actual price. So they are extremely historically significant. But because it's not accessible, it's like the liquidity, the value discovery, like can't happen there. Is that kind of how you saw it play out, or you think that'll change in the future?
So that's definitely an accurate synopsis. There's companies like Emblem Vault that are helping to take those assets and bridge them over and kind of package them in a way that makes more sense and fits into these sort of kind of marketplaces like OpenSea and Blur. But yeah, I mean, this is like the problem for historical NFTs is like, okay, there's some smart contract from before ERC-721 and it's got some really weird code in it. We know they're NFTs, right? There are NFTs. They're not fungible tokens, but you know, you're going to have to figure out a way to wrap these and trade them because the number of people who are willing to go to Etherscan and perform a specific series of like a Leonidas tweet on do this and then call this function and call this function. It's a very small number of people, right? So yeah, basically increasing the accessibility around these assets, I still think is the number one sort of area that the historical NFT space can improve on. Ultimately, that user experience, like you can tweet out the best threads ever. You can interview these incredible people that have created these early experiments. But if people have to do like 3 hours of research just to buy them and, you know, have a 20% chance of like screwing up and losing all of their ETH, that's not a great situation. So yeah, I would love to see more builders sort of focus on, you know, how do we bring these assets into the modern age? It's still the same token, right? But wrapped or bridged in some sort of way where you can have, you know, a market, you know, bring liquidity into that market.
Do you think there'll be a period of time in the future where like the chain literally doesn't matter? Like we're going to have all these different tunnels and, you know, all sorts of different bridges and whatever that are going to make it super easy to transfer NFTs from one chain to another? Or do you, because I would have thought that would have already been a thing, but we're still not there yet. And so I'm kind of losing hope. How do you feel about that?
So when I said a moment ago that the chain doesn't matter, that wasn't necessarily from a, you know, value perspective. That was from a Leonidas curiosity perspective. Cool. If somebody is on Cardano in 2015, I don't even know if Cardano was out in 2015. I don't think it was. But if Cardano existed in 2015 and some artist released this really interesting PFP project experiment, I would find that incredibly fascinating. Like, I don't care that they picked the wrong blockchain to release that on or something. From a value perspective, I think provenance is extremely important. The blockchain does matter, right? Fundamentally, if you spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to acquire this rare digital artifact, specifically an ancient digital artifact, you know, if that blockchain might disappear in 20 years, that's obviously not great for the value of that asset, right? Like, fundamentally, like, why, you know, I think Bitcoin has a really strong argument. And then Ethereum also, I think, you know, these are blockchains that'll be around for a very, very long time. Like, I will sort of make the pitch to folks that, you know, I think Bitcoin will be running in 1,000 years. Like, maybe it's hobbyists running it or something at that point. I don't know. Maybe, you know, AI just changes everything. But I'm pretty confident in saying that the Bitcoin network will be around for an extremely long period of time. And that's a great, great place to store, you know, your non-fungible tokens and digital art on. And that provenance really can't be beat.
All right. So I want to do a little bit of a 101 here. And so these are going to be entry-level questions for you. Hopefully it's fine. But could you explain to me, like, what are ordinals? And pretend I know absolutely nothing.
Okay. All right. So ordinals as a protocol are essentially Bitcoin NFTs. Unfortunately, Bitcoin doesn't have smart contracts. So this really clever guy named Casey Rodemore had to essentially hack NFTs into Bitcoin in a way that nobody had ever really thought of. So there's two components to this. There's the ownership token and then the digital art file. So the ownership token is Casey figuring out a way to individually track all of the sats on the Bitcoin network. Each one becomes a non-fungible token when viewed through the lens of ordinal theory. It's like looking at Bitcoin with a special set of glasses on. And if you take that and you pair it with a digital file that you inscribe onto the Bitcoin network, so this is literally taking like a JPEG that's, you know, 200 kilobytes, submitting it to the Bitcoin network and saying, here's $500. I want you to host this forever. I'm not using you to transfer Bitcoin around different UTXOs and addresses. I'm using you to host my file. And it turns out that's an incredibly powerful use case of Bitcoin that no one had really ever thought of, right? The ability to, for a very specific set of files, you know, pay this one-time fee, store it on a network for hundreds of years, have this, you know, very high assurance that the United States of America's entire military could be, you know, sent and told, I want you to take down this file, and that file could not be taken down. It turns out that's an incredible property to have if you're an artist that wants your work to outlive you, or if you're a collector spending millions of dollars to acquire, you know, this collectible piece that you want to hand down to your grandchildren or something like this. So that immutability and sort of the ability to use Bitcoin as a database was one of the huge innovations with ordinals. And fundamentally, that primitive, which is the sat, which is the ownership of that on-chain file, and then that file that's stored on-chain, what you get is a primitive for a fully on-chain NFT primitive on Bitcoin, and that is called ordinals or the ordinals protocol.
Awesome. Okay, so why, tell me about inscriptions, because, you know, in the ETH world and I guess other blockchains, people say, like, I'm going to mint this NFT. In the ordinals world, it's, I mean, I'm inscribing this NFT. if that's right. Even the correct terminology. But why is it inscribing versus like minting?
The most honest answer there is Casey really likes to pick new words. So we have words like recursion and parent-child and, you know, rare sats and runes and just all of these like crazy terms that Casey created. And that's just Casey's mind creating this fun new world. And I think it's actually this more broader vision of trying to create a culture where we're not just copy pasting from Ethereum and trying to do something our own way. And I think the language is actually really important there. It helps to create this loyal bond between the individuals that speak that language, although it is not great for onboarding. I have noticed.
No, but I think it is, that's a great point. It's really important to culture to be able to have your own language and the people that are in the know kind of speak it. And it requires some upfront mental bandwidth in order to like enter this ecosystem, to learn about it and to become like a member, quote unquote. And then when you're in it, you can speak the local language and it's right. Kind of like fun and cool and interesting, right? So, all right. So why do inscriptions cost a certain amount of sats? Like, why do you need to spend money in order to inscribe stuff?
Yeah. So the way the Bitcoin protocol works is every 10 minutes, a block gets mined. And that block is essentially just 4 megabytes of data. And historically, up until about a year ago, people were saying, hey, store this little piece of data that says, you know, John sent 1 Bitcoin to Sally. And now people are using that to upload giant JPEGs. So now there's two groups of people competing for that 4 megabytes. You can imagine we've gotten along very well with the folks who like using the Bitcoin network to send money back and forth. And yeah, that's what's happening. So you basically have to pay a fee that's correlated. It's proportionate to the size of the file. So let's say if you look at the ordinals market, there's a lot of pixel art. So why is that? Well, to store a little tiny, 20 by 20, pixel art PFP on chain, that literally will cost you like $1, right? It's very, very tiny file. If you want to store this beautiful, piece of one-of-one piece of art, you could literally be spending tens of thousands of dollars. And we've seen instances of projects spending millions of dollars to inscribe files onto Bitcoin. So it's very much a free market for that 4 megabytes. And whatever the market is willing to pay for that 4 megabytes of space every 10 minutes is the price to inscribe that data to Bitcoin.
Amazing. Okay. So you're talking about like size and space and whatnot. You actually just, I want to say it was like, honestly, 30, 40 minutes ago, you sold the largest ordinal inscription ever. Can you explain how it was the largest and how?
Yeah. So a little backstory here would be there's sort of been this competition for who can create the largest inscription that's been going on since the beginning of ordinals. And it started out, this guy, Udi Wertheimer, worked with Luxor Mining, a mining pool, to inscribe this very large file very early, back at inscription number 652. And that was a catalyst for aggravating a lot of these laser eye maxi folks who were like, you just took over our entire block. Like, what are you doing? Like, this is an attack on the Bitcoin network. And it's since evolved. Those people have sort of chilled out a little bit. And, Bitcoin Magazine comes in and one-ups them, and it's this whole thing. And then, I'm doing this, airdrop initiative called Runestone that's meant to be this kind of free airdrop that's meant to be as fair of a distribution as possible. There's no team allocation. It's just a bunch of people in the Ordinals community pitching in to create an airdrop to reward the year one Ordinals community with this beautiful Runestone. And that Runestone is a one-of-one piece created by this French artist, Leo Claire. And it turns out that it would look way better to have a file on Bitcoin if you can go up to 4 megabytes, right? If you're constrained to 400 kilobytes, well, that's a tenth of the file size. And that's a limitation. That's a constraint. So we worked with Marathon Digital Holdings and OrdinalsBot to essentially do this sort of custom Bitcoin block where they mined a block, took this transaction that we crafted that all it does is take this very, very large file and stores it onto Bitcoin. And that gets around essentially a bunch of these standardness rules. You can't do that without working with a miner or a mining pool. So we did that last week and, it's been really exciting. Like, it was really well received. I think there is sort of this crown you get to wear for having the largest file. And I don't necessarily wear that crown. Like, it's really the community that's made this happen that kind of has that honor. But, you know, we'll see if somebody ever comes along and one ups it. But we got very close to 4 megabytes. So there's a few bytes in there you could probably work with, but very much a team effort of a bunch of people coming together. And just huge shout out to the Ordinals bot team and Marathon for, you know, their engineers really are the ones who made this happen.
That's awesome. Yeah. And to kind of dig a little deeper there. So this project, you are, so just to give some context, I think the auction ended at like 8 Bitcoin. Someone bought it for 8 Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, correct. It just ended at 8 Bitcoin.
And what is that, like $560,000 or something?
Yeah, a little over 500K.
But all that money, that's not going to you. Like, that is going to this airdrop initiative to reward, or, you know, yeah, I suppose reward the earliest people that were active in this community from year one. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So 100% of the proceeds for the auction, like the entire purpose of doing the auction, was to raise some funds, and it allows us to essentially do this very large scale airdrop. Ordinals has never seen a collection, you know, of non-text inscriptions this large, and there's never been an Ordinals airdrop this large. And, you know, it turns out, I'm sure people aren't surprised by this, but when you inscribe 112,383 files onto Bitcoin, that isn't cheap. So this is helping with, it's a two-stage airdrop that we're doing here. So very much appreciative. Congrats to Buoyant Capital for winning that auction. And yeah, those fees are going to fundamentally help, you know, do this airdrop, cover the Bitcoin network fees to do the airdrop. And that's, you know, made possible through this purchase.
Yeah. Is there a process you guys can do in order to try to reduce the cost of that? Just because, I mean, that's just such a large amount of people. And as you mentioned, it's never been done to this size before. How can you reduce the costs?
We're going to get a little technical here, but essentially you can't get around like having 112,000 UTXOs and, you know, transferring these little SAT packets to different addresses. But you can get really clever with the actual inscription part. Like, the distribution part is pretty fixed on what you can do there. The inscription part, we're going to use batch inscribing. So that's going to allow us to do about 1,400 together per block. This is the most efficient way you can do this. It's been out for about 2 months on the Ordinals protocol. And then there's also this feature called delegation. And we were kind of debating like how, like, it's an open project, right? Where it's just, we have a Discord and people are sharing ideas and coming up with ways and trying to figure out how to do this. And Casey weighed in and was like, why don't you guys use delegation? And delegation is this feature of the Ordinals protocol that just came out that allows us to inscribe just very tiny, like 40 bytes that says, hey, this inscription points to this other inscription. So that giant file we just talked about, the runestone, that's huge. All 112,000 of these inscriptions is just going to point to that file. And the Ordinals protocol will show that inscription, that really large file, in each of these inscriptions. So they're all identical. Cool. And, you know, if we didn't do it that way, we're talking like, you know, this is the kind of thing where very quickly you're going up orders of magnitude with cost, that it can get quite expensive. So that's gonna allow us to do this. It's all relative because the mempool is very volatile. There's, you know, a fee market on Bitcoin that's always changing, very similar to gas on Ethereum. So we're gonna all get stoned very soon.
That's awesome. I love that. All right. So let's say I'm an artist. Okay. You're an artist. I'm an artist. Okay. I want to upload 100 stick figures. Which beautiful stick figures, like very simple, you know, just like black ink and then, you know, white backgrounds, right? Super, super basic. You're going to upload 100 super beautiful generative art pieces. Could you throw out like a guesstimate of cost that would be for each of us to inscribe those onto Ordinals?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because I think most listeners are probably thinking he's going to say that the stick figures are the cheapest and the generative art would be the most expensive, but it's actually the opposite. Because generative art is really just code. So code and text is actually a very tiny file to store on Bitcoin. So you can take, people have basically already taken these JavaScript packages like 3JS that, you know, Artblocks and these generative art platforms use and that these generative artists use. So that's already inscribed onto Bitcoin. So in the Ordinals protocol, you can basically, there's a language called recursion that allows you to import that into your file. And then you can just, in a few lines of code, you know, have your algorithm that's very tiny And then in that way, have this beautiful output that you inscribed. And literally, like, what I'm trying to convey here is that once you inscribe the algorithm for Fidenza, you could literally create 1,000 Fidenzas and it would cost you like $1 or $2 each. It's extremely inexpensive. If you were to take photographs of these beautiful Andrew stick figures, then that file, like, it turns out like a 400 kilobyte image is you can very easily get to a 400 kilobyte image. And that's going to set you back at current mempool prices, like, you know, $1,000, maybe $2,000. So
total,
per. So, per.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not cheap. Right. I think it's very uncommon to see photography because of that. It just, you know, huge props to the photographers who have done it, but it's not very accessible to most photographers, right? They can't afford to spend, you know, $100,000, $200,000 for a 100-piece collection. You need to have the demand on the collector side if you're going to do that.
Awesome. I think there's some really cool, I mean, I think art, especially art and collectibles, it's all about narrative, story, and kind of that whole, it's nebulous. It's not like, here's the cash flow and here's the revenue, blah, blah, blah. And so I think that there's a cool factor to being like, hey, I'm a photographer and I want to upload my most favorite photograph of ever. And, you know, here it is. And it cost me $2,000, let's say, to upload that. There's something kind of special in a weird way, you know, to say like, I'm spending so much money to show this to everyone on Ordinals because I love this thing so much, right?
Right.
I don't know. It's kind of an interesting dynamic there. But all right, so explain to me rare sats. Like, you've been saying, there's individual Satoshis and some of them are rare. Can you explain that?
So yeah, there's many aspects to Ordinals, right? And one of them is rare sats. So I would think of this as this very emerging asset class. Like, people understand inscriptions because it's just NFTs. It's NFTs on Bitcoin. Rare sats don't really have a corollary, right? Like, rare sats are essentially saying, through ordinal theory, you can track every Satoshi. Literally all 2.1 quadrillion of these sats have a unique number. You can look at how old it is. You can look about and see all this information and exactly where it's traced back to in the Coinbase of the reward for a Bitcoin miner in a block. So it turns out that's really interesting to certain collectors who care about the provenance of a Satoshi. So for example, if a Satoshi was mined by Satoshi Nakamoto, we call those Nakamoto sats. That's interesting to collectors. That is, a market forms around that, where the demand for a Nakamoto sat is valued at greater than one Satoshi. Most of the sats on Bitcoin, they're still boring sats. Bitcoin still works. Everything's fine. But there's these little slices of Bitcoin where, for example, if a sat was in the Bitcoin pizza transaction that everybody knows about, if a sat was mined by Hal Finney, if a sat is the oldest sats in circulation from Block 9, if a sat is part of this rarity scheme that Casey created, where it's an uncommon sat, it's the first sat mined in a block. These are all categories that I sort of encourage people to think of them as like fungible tokens that are native to Bitcoin. Even though you can trade the individual sats sort of like NFTs, the actual market around them is not specifically looking at every individual sat and just saying, I bought 50,000 Block 9 sats. That's sort of how people think about that. So at a high level, like, you know, to a lot of people, that just sounds super nerdy and kind of ridiculous, but there is an extremely passionate group of people that collect these and trade these. There's marketplaces being built around these. And even there's this sort of new class of businesses, I guess at this point, you can call them, where they're called rare sat hunters. So what these people do is they take a bunch of Bitcoin that they have, they send it to Binance or Coinbase, they withdraw that Bitcoin, they then run that Bitcoin through an algorithm to check if there's any valuable rare Satoshis in it. They'll then extract the rare sats, send the non-rare sats, the common sats, back to Binance or Coinbase or whatever hot wallet, and then just do that process over and over. And that's actually been automated at this point. So there's just robots that do this. And like, I was interviewing someone the other day who's doing $400 million of volume a day there. So we're talking, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of scale, extremely high amounts of the Bitcoin supply moving through these individual wallets. And it's effectively creating this new dynamic in Bitcoin where you can almost earn yield on your Bitcoin by sending it to one of these bots. Because what you need is an old, we're going down the rabbit hole, I'll stop here in a second, but you need an old Coinbase account or an old Binance account where you're going to have really high withdrawal and deposit limits. And then you need a lot of Bitcoin. It's not going to be efficient because you're competing against people who can withdraw 1,000 Bitcoins at a time. And then that's allowing them to be much more cost effective with the transaction fees, which ultimately end up being the delta on if you're going to be profitable or not. And then there's these dynamics where, you know, let's say Bitcoin shoots from, you know, 30K to 70K like it just did. Well, during this last month, it's been a great time to be a rare sat hunter because there's people taking Bitcoin that's been offline forever and bringing it online to sell it. So those sats are kind of coming into circulation and there's all this new Bitcoin that's, you know, available in these hot wallets to be mined. Whereas 2 months ago, you know, these rare sat hunters were just sifting through the same sats over and over and over because the market's gotten that efficient. So, you know, people are effectively saying, hey, I'm going to hunt for these rare sats. And they spend a bunch of money on transaction fees to do this. And, you know, once every couple of weeks, they'll find a sat worth, you know, $200,000. And that's what they're doing. So a whole industry there. We don't have to go too much further down that, but it's one of those rabbit holes that there's people building businesses and, you know, spending their entire last year focused on just that specific aspect of the ordinal space. And, you know, Sotheby's just had an auction, you know, auctioning off a bunch of these really interesting Satoshis. So very, very much an exciting time for rare sat folks. I know there's a lot of people who've been kind of believing in that from the early days where, you know, maybe the ordinal NFT inscriptions had more of the focus. The rare sats are definitely maturing as an asset class as well.
That's so cool. Also, okay, I've been seeing some artists, they're able to, you know, they not only upload their art, let's say it's generative in this case, they not only upload it to ordinals, but they're first obtaining rare sats to then upload their piece of art onto that specific rare sat. How does that process happen or work?
Right. So kind of going back to what we were talking about before, where Casey had to, in a really clever way, hack NFTs onto Bitcoin. You've got the file, you've got the sat. The sat is the ownership token of that file. We all sort of agree that this file, it's just going to sit in all the Bitcoin full nodes. It's not moving around. Like that file doesn't move from one wallet to another when you, you know, are using the Ordinals protocol. But the sat is being tracked as you move Bitcoin around. So effectively, because there's a Satoshi that's tied to the inscription file, then if you pick an interesting Satoshi, which people are doing, and saying, hey, you know, this is a piece of art inspired by Hal Finney, and it's a commentary on Hal Finney's life. And then you take a block 78 sat and inscribe on that. It's a really interesting sort of narrative where the Satoshi that's native to Bitcoin is being tied to the actual piece of art, and it informs the art. So that the sat sort of becomes interlaced with the artwork itself. And there's, you know, these artists like Nolish that are, you know, kind of creating careers out of, you know, really learning about rare sats and then creating art that ties into these sats and creates this kind of unique piece of art that's only possible on Bitcoin.
That's so cool. All right. So you said that sats are kind of like fungible tokens on Bitcoin. BRC20s. Can you tell me all about BRC20s or just kind of the high level?
Yeah. So essentially what happened earlier last year was we got NFTs on Bitcoin. And then very naturally, I think people realized, you know, let's do fungible tokens on Bitcoin. And what that manifested itself as is BRC20, which is this protocol. Again, not to get too much into the details, but essentially it's this account model using JSON inscriptions and a meta protocol indexer to have fungible tokens on Bitcoin. And this company, Unisat, built the indexer. This guy named Domo created the kind of idea for it and tweeted out the protocol and is the founder of the protocol. And just very quickly after that, it just took fire. And the rest is kind of history, right? Like, you know, there's BRC20 tokens on Binance now with billion-dollar market caps. And it's been incredible to watch that whole aspect of the space play out as well. And those are fundamentally stored on the Ordinals protocol as inscriptions. So it's this really weird situation where if you come to Bitcoin and you're like, I want to trade fungible tokens, and you go to a NFT marketplace and you're buying NFTs, you're like, what's going on here? Well, we hacked fungible tokens into Bitcoin on an NFT protocol is what happened. So that's a super high level. Really, all you need to know, though, is that just like there's ERC20 on Ethereum, we have fungible tokens here on Bitcoin now as well.
That's awesome. Okay, so I guess, like, creatively speaking, what are some cool things you can do on Ordinals that you can't do on other chains. So this is from a perspective of like an artist or a creator that wants to make something pretty cool. How can I differentiate, you know, my artwork, my collectible, my whatever, versus like an Ethereum based NFT?
Yeah. So I think the longevity component is really important, right? There's sort of like, I'm not an artist, so take everything I say with a grain of salt here. You trust me, you do not want to see Leonidas artwork. If you have the mentality of saying, I'm going to create this thing and I'm going to permanently store that digital file, and it's going to essentially become as tangible and permanent as like a marble sculpture from the ancient like Greco-Roman days. And it's going to be around for our civilization, whatever we're doing, in 1,000 years. That's a really different mentality than, you know, I'm going to create this piece and I'm going to, you know, have a link to AWS, or I'm going to put it on IPFS and we'll cross our fingers that it's here in 100 years. Like, I feel pretty confident around a lot of these storage solutions. When you store things off chain, they'll probably be around in 5 or 10 years. As an NFT historian, I know that a lot of them won't be around in 5 years. I think a lot of the really high value ones definitely will be. There's a collector base that's going to steward those files and ensure they're still around. But I do wonder about 50 years, 100 years from now. I think there's something about creating a piece of art and storing it on chain on Bitcoin that does inform what you're creating. And I think just understanding the implications of, you know, you're putting your art into the Bitcoin blockchain forever. So that should mean something to you. And you should take your time and do something very thoughtful. Just as an example for the Runestone, you know, worked with this incredible French artist, and he spent the last 15 years, you know, chiseling away at these marble blocks and creating these just beautiful, I can't even process how you would go about creating these kind of things. Like, I don't think there's that many people in the world who, you know, understand that art form, and he's one of them. And he creates these incredible sculptures of people mostly. And he's starting with a marble block and creating the sculpture, and that sculpture is going to last forever. And, you know, having him come to Bitcoin and taking a Bitcoin block and carving that into the Runestone, for example, and that's going to last forever. That's a really special thing, right? That transcends this sort of digital physical boundaries. And I just think there's a lot of stories to be told there. And I think we haven't fully appreciated the value of using Bitcoin as a database. My sort of prediction is that in 20 years, it will be very hard to store like any of these files on Bitcoin because it will be so exorbitantly expensive. So we're in this beautiful moment in time, this window where you can inscribe these files to Bitcoin. And I think ultimately it's a very special window. And I would encourage artists who are, you know, thinking about, you know, what do I want my legacy to be? I would think about, what do you want to create that's going to last for an extremely long period of time, and put that on Bitcoin? And whatever that piece is for you, I think that's a very special thing. And I think that longevity component is very special.
All right. So do you think that Ordinals will be mostly a place for art and collectible NFTs? Or can you foresee a future where there's like, I don't know, gaming assets and RWAs and like other types of use cases pertaining to NFTs?
So Bitcoin L1 is somewhat limited. There are people that have inscribed these like smaller retro video games. So you literally can play fully on chain, little tiny fun games on Bitcoin. But there's this whole other world of what's called Bitcoin L2s. And I would imagine most of that sort of like very advanced, you know, if you're trying to do like a DAO that has a bunch of these mechanics, or you're trying to do, you know, a game where you need a lot more transactions per second than Bitcoin layer one handles, you're going to do that on these layer twos on Bitcoin. And there's a lot of energy right there going on there right now. And I would imagine, you know, I think that'll take a few years to play out. I don't think it's going to happen quite as quickly as people are expecting it to, but it eventually will play out. And you're going to have pretty much, in my opinion, everything you can do on Ethereum on Bitcoin layer twos. And that's an incredibly exciting future for Bitcoin and being able to inherit the security and decentralization that makes BTC so valuable and apply that to an L2 to secure that L2. And then those assets on that L2 also inherit that security. That's an unbeatable narrative from my perspective.
That's awesome. Okay. So I've been hearing, you know, this is earlier on, this is a kind of like towards the beginning of 23. I'd say Q1, Q2 of 23. So now I don't hear this talk as much anymore. But early on, I was hearing like Ordinals is impacting Bitcoin network security like negatively, like it's bad. And then other people are saying, no, it's great because it's more fees for the miners. And then, you know, how does Ordinals impact the Bitcoin network in terms of security? Does it make it more secure or less secure?
So you have to take everything you hear with a grain of salt, because what's fundamentally played out in the last year on Bitcoin is sort of a power struggle and dynamic where there's a group of people who sort of controlled the governance process and culture around Bitcoin. And they had sort of fought off these Web3 use cases for a very long time and sort of created this cult around vilifying them. And then, you know, people like myself come in and are like, we want to do NFTs on Bitcoin. And to them, that is like the absolute worst possible thing that you could do on planet Earth. So using their block space for JPEGs. So I guess there's like this dynamic of, you know, people are going to make different arguments. I don't think it has anything to do with the truth or reality. I think it's purely people having a power struggle. You know, I can give my version of events and you could bring a Bitcoin maxi on here and they'll give you a very compelling version of their events. I think it's ultimately a battle of, you know, who's going to determine the future of the Bitcoin network, and people will pretty much say or do anything in order to do that. So I would argue that you just got to listen to both sides and take everything with a grain of salt, understanding that context. My opinion is it's amazing for Bitcoin security, because Bitcoin's probably the best argument against Bitcoin is that every halving, every 4 years, the reward that you get for a Bitcoin block as a miner for securing the Bitcoin network drops in half. So effectively, that means that, you know, in April, in 6 weeks, the security budget, the difficulty to 51% attack Bitcoin goes down by half. That's not a good thing, right? So we're going to supplement those fees by having other activity on the Bitcoin network. The Laser Eye Maxis would rather you have very low fees on Bitcoin forever and nobody ever uses Bitcoin, and it's just a store of value. And I think fundamentally the flaw in that logic is that, you know, given enough time, you know, these more of these halvings happen, and then all of a sudden the miners aren't very incentivized, and you can, you know, attack a network that has $100 trillion of value for $50 billion. Well, that's not a great outcome. So we're proposing this future where Bitcoin is going to be used for all of these Web3 things, and that fundamentally drives up the fees on the network. And those fees are just payments to the Bitcoin miners who are having to then essentially expend electricity to secure the network. So Bitcoin is objectively, in my opinion, more secure because of the activity of Ordinals people. I think just to really quickly give the counterpoint, there's an argument that, I don't know how deep we want to get into this, but basically there's an argument that, you know, we are sort of polluting the network and, you know, potentially we have, I'll give one example, block 840,000 at the halving is coming up. There is a sat that's going to be mined in that block that's worth several $1 million. The Runes protocol is coming out in that block that's going to have unique tickers that will be claimable that are worth in excess of hundreds of millions of dollars potentially. And there's going to be a mining pool that wins that block. And that's an extremely valuable thing to win. So the question is, okay, these people came onto our network and started doing all this crazy stuff. Well, what if that breaks the network and creates these weird game theoretical kind of collusion incentives for miners? You know, we didn't have that when we weren't doing NFTs on Bitcoin. What, like, you know what I'm saying? So it's not a totally invalid argument. I'm personally not so worried about it. If, you know, Udi and me inscribing large JPEGs onto Bitcoin breaks Bitcoin, right? Like, that's probably good. We're figuring that out before we have the world reserve currency stored on this network. So personally, I'm, you know, not at all worried about this. If we have a day-long reorg for that situation, so be it. There's a ton of points people can make. There's been extreme efforts to censor Ordinals. Lots of Bitcoin core devs not happy about it, Luke Dash Jr. being the most sort of prolific. But all of those efforts have sort of failed, because fundamentally, as long as we pay for our block space and we use the network in the way it works, then you're going to essentially have to fork or something to get rid of us. And I think that would be a very unpopular thing to do, since we have essentially the venture community, the mining community, and a very passionate group of, you know, Web3 people that are now incentivized for this activity to continue on the network.
Totally. That's awesome. Okay. So, you know, when Ethereum NFTs really took off, I'd say it was 21 roughly. And I mean, they were obviously there before that, but you had all these people that had lots of Ethereum that suddenly had something to spend it on. Whereas before right. it was like, yeah, I can DeFi and a few other things, but now it's like, oh, I can like buy like goods. I can buy art and cool things like that. And you know, the net worth of Ethereum holders, it was large, but now we have this situation happen on Bitcoin, which, you know, the Bitcoin, the net worth of Bitcoin holders is like significantly larger. What are you seeing happen this past year? Because are you seeing like there's been a flood of people coming in saying, oh my gosh, this is awesome, I'm going to spend my money like crazy? Or like, how has the price action been because you have this user base of people with high net worth?
So I think there is this sort of narrative going around that, and it's accurate, there's an extremely deep amount of liquidity on Bitcoin. There's $1.5 trillion of BTC to be unlocked. I don't think we've done a super great job of unlocking that so far. What I've seen is mostly people from Ethereum and Solana coming over. They're already NFT collectors. They're already digital kind of crypto natives that just want to collect NFTs on Bitcoin, because of course you want to collect NFTs on Bitcoin. And that's most of the capital that's been inflowing. So I would love for us to mature and, you know, get Michael Saylor to buy, you know, an inscription. Like, I think moments like that will come. But for now, I think the most honest answer is that it's almost exclusively, the capital is almost exclusively flowing from these other NFT ecosystems into Bitcoin. And I think that larger unlock will just take time because, you know, most people don't even know what an ordinal is or haven't heard about it. So it's really this group of people during a bear market who are just super plugged in on Twitter all day. And then I think eventually, we actually saw on CNBC 2 days ago, you know, they were talking about what's the bull case for BTC, what's driving the price up. And for the first time, they pointed out that the developer activity and the Web3 activity on Bitcoin is giving it this kind of huge leg up against Ethereum right now. And that narrative is starting to merge. And what effectively that means is, you know, the 200 million people in the world who own Bitcoin, they don't necessarily care about ordinals, but they do care about the Bitcoin price going up. It's fundamentally a speculative asset still. That's why they're holding the Bitcoin. So if they believe ordinals makes their Bitcoin price go up, which I believe that narrative is going to merge with the ETF narrative and these other narratives, I mean, that's incredibly, it's incredibly bullish for ordinals, because then we now have this very large group of people learning about ordinals and rooting for the success of the space. And then, you know, once that sort of cultural shift happens and people understand this, just like they had to figure out what a, you know, Bored Ape was in 2021 when, you know, Snoop Dogg or something is singing, you know, with it, right? They're going to learn about ordinals. And I think it will just be purely through the narrative of these ordinals, these Bitcoin L2s are creating this very interesting new dynamic in the crypto ecosystem where Bitcoin now has what Ethereum sort of has. And that's bullish for BTC, the currency, which there's a very large amount of people invested in and incentivized to go up. So that's what I expect to happen. I think it'll take time. I don't think, you know, Michael Saylor is just going to start buying, sweeping the floors tomorrow. But I do think that's the end game.
That's awesome. Okay, so there's been a lot of collections, obviously, the past year. I mean, it really only launched, what, January 23, so obviously. What are some notable projects or collections that you think are cool? You know, we have, there's Node Monks. Is it Node Monks or Node Monkeys?
Well, I think it's debatable.
Okay, interesting.
The founders like never vocally said, right? Like there's no like audio, so it's just a word on Twitter. So my guess is it's Monk.
I have some friends of mine call it Node Monks. I call it Node Monkeys because it just sounds goofier. definitely debatable. But you know, there's some really cool, you know, PFPs or some funny looking things. There's some incredible generative art.
Right.
What are just some notable collections that you think are cool, and like why do you think that those collections are cool?
Yeah, so I'm specifically, when I'm collecting, I'm looking for people pushing the kind of technical boundaries. I really sort of value somebody like Udi coming along and inscribing this huge file onto Bitcoin. Similarly, I would value, you know, a project like Onchain Monkey that's doing the exact opposite. They're seeing how efficient we can be with the block space and how tiny of a file we can create. That's equally as impressive to me and equally as difficult of a technical feat. You've got, you know, people like Nolish. He's got, you know, several collections now that are, you know, sats that he hunted. He inscribed the first, you know, Block 9 sats on his collection. The OMBs then worked with Nolish to inscribe their Green Eyes PFP collection on the Block 9. So there's sort of a provenance related to the first inscription collections on a certain type of rare sat. This exists for pretty much every category of these rare sats. That's something very interesting to me. Nolish is sort of at the core of that narrative, being the earliest sort of sat hunter. And then there's just all sorts of, like, I don't know, like, people are, you know, so staying super high level here, low inscription numbers, there's this aspect of the market. If you don't understand inscription numbers, the market's going to make literally no sense to you. So every NFT you inscribe on Bitcoin, every file gets a number, and it's based on the order in which it was inscribed. So Casey inscribed the first file, that's inscription 0. The next one's 1, 2, 3, so on and so on. I own several of these first 100, so I'm obviously very biased, but I think the idea that the, you know, first inscriptions on this protocol on Bitcoin, that you're now looking at the chain, there's like 60 million of these files, you know, the first 100, the first 1,000, the first 10,000, this is a fairly obvious narrative. We just saw someone pay 24 BTC for inscription number 2 last week. That's definitely something interesting that I'm, you know, biased answer there, but I do think that's sort of this kind of collection that is, it wasn't intended to be a collection, but it's sort of become this sort of interesting collectible club or category. So hopefully that gives an overview. There's so much, and I honestly can't totally keep track. If you're looking for like what the hottest mints are, there's probably better people to ask. I literally can't keep track these days, but there's a lot of really cool stuff. And my final thoughts here would be, look to the people who've been building here for a really long time and didn't just show up in the last month necessarily. There's a lot of people that are going to show up in this month that are going to do really cool stuff, right? Like, there's an incredible amount of concentration of talent on Ethereum that I think it totally makes sense to come, you know, create on Bitcoin. And I want to welcome those people. But there's this cohort of OGs that, like, I personally like to kind of collect from and support. So that's just sort of a personal thing. And then also, yeah, if you can do anything technically interesting, I think you're going to get people's attention.
That's awesome. Okay, so sorry, it took so long to get to this point, but I mean, this conversation has been absolutely incredible. But tell me, like, what is Ord.io? You are a co-founder of this company, Ord.io. Tell me, like, what is that?
Yeah, so my friend Zach and I, you know, saw that Ordinals came out and were like, we should build a web browser for viewing these on-chain files on Bitcoin. And we did that. And, you know, now we've got over 100,000 people every month that come to our site, Ord.io, and you can view all of these files. So you'll go to our homepage, you'll see there's all of these interesting files. Everything you see on our site is fully on-chain. Those content, those files are stored fully on-chain on Bitcoin. And you're browsing this kind of little Bitcoin internet that's been created. And we allow people to, you know, connect their wallet and sign this sort of verifying off-chain signature that allows them to then reply and upvote these. And it's a very fun sort of discoverability platform. So whatever's happening on-chain that's interesting in the Ordinal space will show up on our homepage because people will be upvoting it and talking about it. And then there's also just, you know, very, you know, basic features you'd expect from an explorer, like being able to filter for sats, inscriptions on a certain Satoshi, or sort by the newest inscriptions or the largest inscriptions, and searching for different addresses, and very much something you would expect from an Ordinals Explorer. So that is what Ord.io is. And we're just, we've had an absolute blast for the last year building this. And it's honestly totally exceeded our wildest dreams, not just our product, but the entire ecosystem. The fact that people are willing to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to store files on Bitcoin and use it as a database and sort of validate that it would even be worth it to build an explorer for that. Because at the time, it was definitely not obvious that was the case. We did not expect this protocol to grow as fast as it has. So that's Ord.io. And you know, we're super appreciative of everyone who uses it to kind of explore the Ordinals protocol.
That's awesome. All right. So what is Ord City?
Yeah, so Ord City that's actually unrelated to us. Mm-hmm. Through Runestone. Okay, so Ord City, for people who know, Scarcity is this counterparty platform that's been around for a very long time. It's a bunch of Rare Pepe kind of OG folks, great people. And they're essentially an auction platform for Rare Pepes and these other assets. And they also auction, there's this whole culture around kind of Bitcoin art, like they're not NFTs. It's just, there's a bunch of artists that create kind of real, normal, like, typical art, the way you would think about it, that's associated with Bitcoin, and they're an auction platform for that. And then when Ordinals came out, they spun off their platform to have an Ordinals product. So essentially, you can go to them and say, hey, we would like to do an auction And it's a great platform for doing auctions for ordinals.
That's awesome. Okay. All right. What is the Ordinal Show? You know, you have this awesome newsletter and like weekly podcast that you do. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So a little over a year ago, I met this guy, Trevor and Jan, on just Twitter Spaces about ordinals. And we hit it off and we're like, you know, this is pretty cool. Like there's an ecosystem forming here. Let's start a podcast. Let's do it twice a week. And that's what we've done. Like, it's not super professional, to be completely honest with people. Like, we sort of have like a fun, authentic conversation, hopefully, with folks, and try to keep it mostly focused on the building side of things and not like the sort of project promotion side of things necessarily. And just, we had this goal of, when we started the show, Bitcoin developers, like, it was very much, you would be like harassed and shamed for coming and doing experiments like ordinals on Bitcoin or doing NFTs on Bitcoin. And we wanted to create this atmosphere where that's celebrated. Like, that's sort of the arbitrage that Vitalik realized with Ethereum, was these developers on Bitcoin were not being very nice to people wanting to try experiments and push the boundaries. So I'm going to start my own chain and I'm going to really focus on bringing developers over. And we pretty much identified that, you know, changing that culture on Bitcoin was the number one thing that we could do to at least help with this sort of issue. That was a very significant issue if you roll the clock back a year. So that's what the show's sort of goal and focus has been. And we've gotten to interview pretty much most of the major project founders in the space. And we just bring people on and have conversations and chat about the cool things that are happening in Ordinals and what people are building. So that's a Twitter space we do twice a week. And, you know, love it when people come listen to us. And we have a lot of long-term listeners and lots of new folks listening recently. And everyone's welcome. And I'll apologize on behalf of new listeners. We do speak that language we were referring to earlier, where probably nothing's going to make sense. But if you just keep listening, I think you'll sort of come to appreciate what's happening. It's very much been a really fun part of the last year for myself, and it's an honor to co-host with these guys. So looking forward to hopefully many more years of that.
Amazing. We will definitely link that in the show notes for sure. All right, last one before the closing questions. What is a doozy? What is the future of ordinals? Like when you look out 5, 10 plus years, like how does ordinals look and feel like?
So I think the Bitcoin network gets much more expensive. So you're going to need to be even more cost effective. I don't think you're going to see many photographs stored on chain. I do think you can still do generative art. You can do pixel art. I think, again, because the fees are getting higher, Bitcoin layer one does not scale very well. The one thing that the Laser Eyes and the Ordinals folks are aligned on is that we're going to scale Bitcoin in layers. So pretty much the layer two ecosystem has a lot of work to do over the next couple of years. But I do think they'll get the job done, and we'll have, you know, ZK rollups and optimistic rollups on par with Ethereum, with trustless bridging and everything you would expect in modern L2s. And then I think, yeah, the long game here is people will bridge their assets from L1 to L2s, and that's where a lot of the activity will happen in the future. But I think it just takes a little bit longer than most folks realize for that to actually play out.
That's awesome. All right, Leonidas, this has been amazing. It's time for the closing questions.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right, what are you bearish on? It could be anything.
Ooh, let's see. I could piss a lot of people off by saying Ethereum, but I'm not actually that bearish on Ethereum. I think Ethereum will be around a long time. Everyone's rooting for that kind of competition, but I think most of the folks on Bitcoin are also, like, I hold ETH NFT still, right? Like, I think it's a lot of the same folks holding on multiple chains. I'm bearish on the trend of enforced royalties and operator filters and permissioned ownership of NFTs. Like, when I want to own a digital asset, I want it to be as close to Bitcoin as possible, and I don't want multi-sigs and independent third parties telling me that you can do this with it, but you can't do this with it. I want to own my asset. I want it to be me and my JPEG, and we're going to ride off into the sunset. It's going to be incredible. And that's my personal belief. I think that's how you create the most valuable long-term digital asset.
That's awesome. All right. What are you bullish on? You know, well, you can say, like, besides broadly ordinals, like what are you bullish on?
Yeah.
You can get specific.
I'm bullish on the Bitcoin developer community. I think they're going to just completely change the arc of Bitcoin and usher in a new future that, like, Bitcoin's going to look very different. It's going to look, that might be scary to you, but I think ultimately it's very exciting, because fundamentally, like, even if you believe that the main purpose of the Bitcoin network is to be a currency and, you know, have that be the world reserve currency, and 8 billion people are using that as their, you know, payments. I think the Trojan horse is all of this Web3 activity. And whether you want to call that gambling or speculation, at the end of the day, that's getting a lot of people into these networks. And the ultimate threats here are the nation states, are the sophisticated actors who stand to lose from a decentralized future like this, or a more decentralized future, a more free future. And my personal belief is that, you know, Bitcoin developers, like all of these developers coming and trying, you know, 100,000 different experiments on Bitcoin and creating all these protocols, are going to ultimately ensure that Bitcoin has the highest probability of succeeding, because the more people you get into the network, I think the harder it is to take that network down.
That's awesome. Very cool. All right. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Learn to code.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good piece of advice. It definitely kind of changed the trajectory of, I guess, my life a little bit, you could say. I would say, yeah. I think a lot of people, they're focused on, you know, collecting the hottest new NFT or trading and using their own capital. And I look at a lot of people and I'm like, you're an extremely talented individual. And if you work hard and learn a skill and choose to work in this industry, I think you're going to ultimately realize that that was the true value, not necessarily just kind of trying to find a lottery ticket. That would be my advice to people. Like, you know, whether that's learning to code or, you know, learning some sort of skill set and focusing on, you know, increasing value in the ecosystem, that's what I would focus on rather than being a consumer of other people's things. Of course, nothing wrong with like using products and participating in the ecosystem, but I think that's the true value that everyone really has, is, yeah, working really hard and trying to participate and help join a company, start your own thing. I think that's how we really grow the ecosystem. So
love that.
And that's the value for a lot of folks. And that was certainly, I think, the case for myself. And I'm very appreciative of that advice.
That's awesome. All right. Last question. What motivates you?
Interesting. I would say like it's sort of complex. I definitely, for being honest, like, why did I come to Bitcoin initially? Yeah, I saw this crazy chart and wanted to make money. I'm like an 18-year-old kid. Like, this is insane. I want to get rich. I think eventually the more time you spend in this space, that's always going to be an aspect of it. But I do very much value this. Like, every time you go to a DMV, every time you just have this experience with an intermediary or a third party, and you're just like, what the hell is going on? Why does the world work like this? I think like crypto actually is like somewhat of the answer to that. And I don't know exactly how it all ends up playing out, but I think the whole world has, all 8 billion people on Earth get a little bit more power, a little bit more free will, a little bit more freedom because of this technology. And whether we're doing, you know, gaming or gambling to kind of start that, because that's the early use case for this technology, I think the end game is that in 50 years from now, we look back on this kind of technological paradigm shift that our entire civilization's sort of power structures have moved on to this new technology. And we're like, wow, this is an incredible unlock for humanity. And people just sort of need to zoom out and realize that that's the end game, why we're doing all of this at the end of the day. And hopefully we make money along the way. And I would love to just be a little part of helping to sort of make that future happen.
That's beautiful. Wow. Yeah. It's like, get rich, save the world, you know,
very well said.
Yeah. That's awesome. Cool, man. Well, Leonidas, this was absolutely incredible. Thank you so much for coming on. I had an absolute blast. Learned a ton. If people want to find out more about yourself, more about Ord.io or the Ordinal Show, where should they go?
Yeah. So just if you want to check out cool on-chain files, go to Ord.io. If you want to listen to the Ordinal Show, there's a link in my bio on Twitter. I'm Leonidas NFT on Twitter. Don't click on one of my like 200 scammers that also have my PFP name. Yeah. Look forward to seeing y'all in the Twitter sphere.
Amazing. Awesome. Thank you.
Awesome, Andrew. This has been great. Have a good one.
You too.